land. It was supposed there were 10,000 people to whom I preached Christ, our wisdom, righteousness, sanctification, and redemption. I could not conclude till it was so dark we could scarcely see one another, and there was on all sides the deepest attention, none speaking, stirring, or scarcely looking aside. Surely here, though in a temple not made with hands, was God worshipped in the beauty of holiness. Wednesday the 21st. I was awakened between 3 and 4 by a large company of tinners, who, fearing they should be too late, had gathered round the house and were singing and praising God. At 5 I preached once more on, "Believe on the Lord Jesus Christ, and thou shalt be saved." They all devoured the word. Oh, may it be health to their soul and marrow to their bones. We rode to Launceston that day, Thursday the 22nd. As we were riding through a village called Sticklepath, one stopped me in the street and asked abruptly, "Is not thy name John Wesley?" Immediately 2 or 3 more came up and told me I must stop there. I did so, and before we had spoken many words, our souls took acquaintance with each other. I found they were called Quakers, but that hurt not me, seeing the love of God was in their hearts. A mob at Winsbury, Thursday, October 20th. After preaching to a small, attentive congregation at Birmingham, I rode to Winsbury. At 12, I preached in a ground near the middle of the town to a far larger congregation than was expected, on Jesus Christ, the same yesterday and today and forever, Hebrews 13:8. I believe everyone present felt the power of God, and no creature offered to molest us, either going or coming, but the Lord fought for us, and we held our peace. I was writing at Francis Ward's in the afternoon when the cry arose that the mob had beset the house. We prayed that God would disperse them, and it was so. One went this way and another that, so that in half an hour not a man was left. I told our brethren, "Now is the time for us to go," but they pressed me exceedingly to stay. So that I might not offend them, I sat down, though I foresaw what would follow. Before 5, the mob surrounded the house again in greater numbers than ever. The cry of one and all was, "Bring out the minister, we will have the minister." I desired one to take their captain by the hand and bring him into the house. After a few sentences interchanged between us, the lion became a lamb. I desired him to go and bring one or two more of the most angry of his companions. He brought in 2 who were ready to swallow the ground with rage, but in 2 minutes they were as calm as he. I then bade them make way, that I might go out among the people. As soon as I was in the midst of them, I called for a chair, and standing up asked, "What do any of you want with me?" Some said, "We want you to go with us to the justice." I replied, "That I will, with all my heart." I then spoke a few words which God applied, so that they cried out with might and main, "The gentleman is an honest gentleman, and we will spill our blood in his defense." I asked, "Shall we go to the justice tonight or in the morning?" Most of them cried, "Tonight, tonight," on which I went before, and 200 or 300 followed, the rest returning whence they came. The night came on before we had walked a mile, together with heavy rain. However, on we went to Bentley Hall, 2 miles from Wedsbury. 1 or 2 ran before to tell Mr. Lane they had brought Mr. Wesley before his worship. Mr. Lane replied, "What have I to do with Mr. Wesley? Go and carry him back again." By this time the main body came up and began knocking at the door. A servant told them Mr. Lane was in bed. His son followed and asked what was the matter. One replied, "Why, ain't pleased you? They sing psalms all day, nay, and make folks rise at 5 in the morning. And what would your worship advise us to do?" "Go home," said Mr. Lane, "and be quiet." Wesley in danger. Here they were all at a full stop, till one advised to go to Justice Purr's house at Walsall. All agreed to this, so we hastened on, and about 7 came to his house. But Mr. P. likewise sent word that he was in bed. Now they were at a stand again, but at last they all thought it the wisest course to make the best of their way home. About 50 of them undertook to convoy me, but we had not gone 100 yards when the mob of Walsall came, pouring in like a flood, and bore down all before them. The Darlaston mob made a defense they could, but they were weary as well as outnumbered, so that in a short time, many being knocked down, the rest ran away and left me in their hands. To attempt speaking was vain, for the noise on every side was like the roaring of the sea. So they dragged me along till we came to the town, where, seeing the door of a large house open, I attempted to go in. But a man, catching me by the hair, pulled me back into the middle of the mob. They made no more stop till they had carried me through the main street, from one end of the town to the other. I continued speaking all the time to those within hearing, feeling no pain or weariness. At the west end of the town, seeing a door half open, I made toward it, and would have gone in, but a gentleman in the shop would not suffer me, saying they would pull the house down to the ground. However, I stood at the door and asked, "Are you willing to hear me speak?" Many cried out, "No, no, knock his brains out, down with him, kill him at once." Others said, "Nay, but we will hear him first." I began asking, "What evil have I done? Which of you all have I wronged in word or deed?" And continued speaking for above a quarter of an hour, till my voice suddenly failed. Then the floods began to lift up their voice again, many crying out, "Bring him away, bring him away." In the meantime, my strength and my voice returned, and I broke out aloud in prayer. And now the man who just before headed the mob turned and said, "Sir, I will spend my life for you. Follow me, and not one soul here shall touch a hair of your head." Two or three of his fellows confirmed his words and got close to me immediately. At the same time, the gentleman in the shop cried out, "For shame, for shame, let him go." An honest butcher, who was a little farther off, said it was a shame they should do thus. And he pulled back four or five, one after another, who were running on the most fiercely. The people then, as if it had been by common consent, fell back to the right and left, while those three or four men took me between them and carried me through them all. But on the bridge, the mob rallied again. We therefore went on one side over the mill dam, and thence through the meadows, till a little before 10, God brought me safe to Wednesbury, I having lost only one flap of my waistcoat and a little skin from one of my hands. His presence of mind. I never saw such a chain of provinces before, so many convincing proofs that the hand of God is on every person and thing and overruling all as it seemeth him good. The poor woman of Darlaston, who had headed the mob and sworn that no one should touch me, when she saw her followers give way, ran into the thicket of the throng and knocked down three or four men one after another. But many assaulting her at once, she was soon overpowered and had probably been killed in a few minutes, three men keeping her down and beating her with all their might. Had not a man called to one of them, "Hold, Tom, hold." "Who is there?" said Tom. "Why, honest Munchin." "Nay," they let her go. So they held their hand and let her get up and crawl home as well as she could. From the beginning to the end, I found the same presence of mind, as if I had been sitting in my own study. But I took no thought for one moment after another. Only once it came into my mind that if they should throw me in the river, it would spoil the papers that were in my pockets. For myself, I did not doubt but I should swim across, but having but a thin coat and a light pair of boots. The circumstances that follow, I thought, were particularly remarkable. One, that many endeavored to throw me down while we were going downhill on a slippery path through the town, as well judging that if I was once on the ground, I should hardly rise any more. But I made no stumble at all, nor the least slip, till I was entirely out of their hands. Two, that although many strove to lay hold on my collar or clothes to pull me down, they could not fasten at all. Only one got fast hold of the flap of my waistcoat, which was soon left in his hand. The other flap, in the pocket of which was a banknote, was torn but half off. Three, that lusty man just behind struck at me several times with a large open stick, with which if he had struck me once on the back part of my head, it would have saved him all further trouble. But every time the blow was turned aside, I know not how, for I could not move to the right hand or left. What soft hair he has. Four, another came rushing through the press and raising his arm to strike, on a sudden let it drop and only stroked my head, saying, "What soft hair he has." Five, that I stopped exactly at the mayor's door as if I had known it, which the mob doubtless thought I did, and found him standing in the shop, his presence giving the first check to the madness of the people. Six, that the very first men whose hearts were turned were the heroes of the town, the captains of the rabble on all occasions, one of them having been a prize fighter at the Bear Garden. 7. That from first to last I heard none give a reviling word or call me by any opprobrious name, whatever, but the cry of one and all was, the preacher, the parson, the minister. 8. That no creature, at least within my hearing, laid anything to my charger, either true or false, having in the hurry quite forgotten to provide themselves with an accusation of any kind. And lastly, that they were as utterly at a loss what they should do with me, none proposing any determinate thing, only away with him, kill him at once. By how gentle degrees does God prepare us for his will? 2 years ago, a piece of brick grazed my shoulders. It was a year after that this a stone struck me between the eyes. Last month I received one blow, and this evening two, one before we came into the town and one after we had gone out, but both were as nothing. For though one man struck me on the breast with all his might, and the other on the mouth with such force that the blood gushed out immediately, I felt no more pain from either of the blows than if they had touched me with a straw. It ought not to be forgotten that when the rest of the society made all haste to escape for their lives, 4 only would not stir: William Stitch, Edward Slater, John Griffiths, and Joan Parks. These kept with me, resolving to live or die together, and none of them received one blow but William Stitch, who held me by the arm from one end of the town to the other. He was then dragged away and knocked down, but he soon rose and got to me again. I afterward asked him what he expected when the mob came upon us. He said, to die for him who has died for us, and he felt no hurry or fear, but calmly waited till God should require his soul of him. Wesley's Defenders. I asked J. Parks if she was not afraid when they tore her from me. She said, no, no, no more than I am now. I could trust God for you as well as for myself. From the beginning I had a full persuasion that God would deliver you. I knew not how, but I felt that to him, and was as sure as if it were already done. I asked if the report was true that she had fought for me. She said, no, I knew God would fight for his children. And shall these souls perish at the last? When I came back to Francis Ward's, I found many of our brethren waiting upon God. Many also whom I never had seen before came to rejoice with us. And the next morning, as I rode through the town in my way to Nottingham, everyone I met expressed such a cordial affection that I could scarcely believe what I saw and heard. The Sleepy Magistrate's Proclamation. I cannot close this head without inserting as great a curiosity in its kind as, I believe, was ever yet seen in England, which had its birth within a very few days of this remarkable occurrence at Walsall, Staffordshire. To all high constables, petty constables, and other of His Majesty's peace officers within the said county, and particularly to the constable of Tipton, near Walsall. Whereas we, His Majesty's Justices of the Peace, for the said county of Stafford, have received information that several disorderly persons, styling themselves Methodist preachers, go about raising routs and riots to the great damage of His Majesty's liege people and against the peace of our Sovereign Lord the King. These are, in His Majesty's name, to command you and every one of you within your respective districts to make diligent search after the said Methodist preachers, and to bring him or them before some of us, said Majesty Justices of the Peace, to be examined concerning their unlawful doings. Given under our hands and seals, this day of October, 1743, J. Lane, W. Purse House. N.B. The very justices to whose houses I was carried, and who severely refused to see me. Saturday, the 22nd, I rode from Nottingham to Epworth, and on Monday set out for Grimsby. But at ferry we were all at a full stop, the boatman telling us we could not pass the Trent. It was as much as our lives were worth to put from shore before the storm abated. We waited an hour, but being afraid it would do much hurt if I should disappoint the congregation at Grimsby, I asked the men if they did not think it possible to get to the other shore. They said they could not tell, but if we would venture our lives, they would venture theirs. So we put off, having 6 men, 2 women, and 3 horses in the boat. Wesley nearly drowned. Many stood looking after us on the riverside when we reached the middle of the river. In an instant, the side of the boat was under water and the horses and men rolling one over another. We expected the boat to sink every moment, but I did not doubt of being able to swim ashore. The boatmen were amazed as well as the rest, but they quickly recovered and rowed for life. And soon after, our horses leaping overboard, the boat was lightened, and we all came unhurt to land. They wondered what was the matter. I did not rise, for I lay alone in the bottom of the boat, and wondered too, till upon examination I found that a large iron crow, which the boatmen sometimes used, was, none knew how, run through the string of my boot, and was pinning me down, that I could not stir. If the boat had sunk, I should have been safe enough from swimming any further. The same day, and as near as we could judge, the same hour, the boat in which my brother was crossing the Severn at the new passage was carried away by the wind and in the utmost danger of splitting upon the rocks. But the same God, when all human hope was past, baptism on the stage. Monday the 31st, we set out early in the morning and in the evening came to Newcastle. Wednesday, November 2nd, the following advertisement was published. For the benefit of Mr. Estee, by the Edinburgh Company of Comedians, on Friday, November 4th, will be acted a comedy called The Conscious Lovers, to which will be added a farce called Trick Upon Trick, or Methodism Displayed. On Friday, a vast multitude of spectators were assembled in the Moot Hall to see this. It was believed there could not be less than 1,500 people, some hundreds of whom sat on rows of seats built upon the stage. Soon after the comedians had begun the first act of the play, on a sudden all those seats fell down at once, the supporters of them breaking like a rotten stick. The people were thrown one upon another, about 5 foot forward, but not one of them was hurt. After a short time, the rest of the spectators were quiet and the actors went on. In the middle of the second act, all the shilling seats gave a crack and sank several inches down. A great noise and shrieking followed, and as many as could readily get to the door went out and returned no more. Notwithstanding this, when the noise was over, the actors went on with the play. In the beginning of the third act, the entire stage suddenly sank about 6 inches. The players retired with great precipitation, yet in a while they began again. At the latter end of the third act, all 6 penny seats, without any kind of notice, fell to the ground. There was now a cry on every side, it being supposed that many were crushed in pieces. But upon inquiry, not a single person, such was the mercy of God, was either killed or dangerously hurt. 200 or 300 remaining still in the hall, Mr. Estee, who was to act the Methodist, came upon the stage and told them that for all this he was resolved the farce should be acted. While he was speaking, the stage sank 6 inches more. At this he ran back to the utmost confusion, and the people as fast as they could out the door, none staying to look behind him. Which is most surprising, that those players acted this farce the next week, or that some hundreds of people came again to see it? Chapter 6. First Methodist Conference. Press gangs and mobs, Wesley's protest against ungodliness. The First Conference, 1744, Monday, June 18th. I left Epworth and on Wednesday the 20th in the afternoon met my brother in London. Monday the 25th, and the 5 following days we spent in conference with many of our brethren, come from several parts, who desire nothing but to save their own souls and those who hear them. And surely, as long as they continue thus minded,